Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nakiko.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week, Tuesdays at noon, live. Yes, we come to you live from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes, indeed. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, practicalfarmers.org. Plus, the Donalana Kitchen Show is also sponsored by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. Find out about the annual Burns Night Supper to be held this week, Friday, January 25th at Ryman Gardens. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I'm going to start out with a Donalana Kitchen news item. Yes, we have. I want to let people know that the moon did come back. It did come back. We had your major eclipse event.
Highly visible. Charmingly visible.
A little cloudy, but it was charmingly visible. There was a super blood wolf moon, which had all kinds of implications. But anyway, it was lovely to watch.
With lots of atmospheric moisture swirling around, and it was late at night, and oh boy, oh boy.
And actually, before that, here in Ames, in central Iowa, there was a lovely event that celebrated and led up to this. A bunch of local folk did a musical. They wrote and produced this fantastic musical called Moon Rock. It was great.
It got us all focused on them. It was fabulous.
It was
just fabulous.
In the tradition of, you know, in these old movies when Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland would look at one another and say, I know, let's make a show. And they did.
Oh, my goodness. And what a great production values, fabulous music, wonderful dancing, wonderful costumes. And it was all homemade.
It was about a... I don't want to tell you what it was about because it was just too wonderfully crazy, but it had some moon stuff in it. It was written and produced by Lindsay Nissen and Sasha Andropov with all kinds of local musicians.
And it was a packed house at the City Auditorium. Sold out.
It was good job. I think that had something to do with the moon coming back because here we are.
We're holding on to the moon here. Just from Ames, we're generating
enough energy
to keep the universe running.
So three cheers to Moon Rock, the musical. Yes, and another good gathering this weekend, end of last week and this weekend, the Practical Farmers of Iowa Conference was this weekend. Of
course, 600 farmers from all over Iowa. What a to-do. So much fun.
That great keynote speakers, great sessions.
We roasted two whole pigs for the occasion.
The best part, the Friday night potluck for all those. You said about 350 people came?
Absolutely. And Story City Locker got the Nyman Ranch pigs, and Lana did the table decorations, and I made polenta, and another local production happened again.
That was good. It's nice to get together and do all of that, celebrate the producers, celebrate food, celebrate what we know about each other, all sorts of farmers. So farmers, the big farmers, little farmers, even people that aren't farmers that are interested in local food.
And both events, I'm very pleased to say, were extremely multi-generational.
Oh, very.
We do that well in this town. The young, the old, and everybody in between.
All sorts of us.
We know how to get along.
Oh, and I want to do, food is always good, because besides all the stuff that was, the pig and all that kind of stuff, people bring potluck dishes, and I don't know who brought this, but Donna and I kind of, you know, go around, check things out, and we both.
Every year we pick our favorite dessert, sort of in advance. Last year it was the persimmon pudding from
Redfern Farm.
This year, we don't know who made this, so if you were listening, call us and tell us about the recipe, but
yeah,
it was...
Rye flour brownies.
Yes, I believe it said whole rye flour brownies.
So think of it. Think of the taste of rye. Think of chocolate, chocolate, chocolate. Put those two together. Whoever did that.
It was a brilliant combination. Subtle, brilliant. But rich. The brownies were the better for the rye, I have to say. It was a very good, good idea.
What a good weekend. So today on the Donna Lana Kitchen, Donna says we're going to get a little wonky today.
Oh, yes, we're going to talk about some very complicated aspects of our global food system so we can kind of get a handle on it.
Yeah. What in the world should we eat? We all try to be informed consumers, but how do we interpret all of this stuff? So to our kitchen table today, we welcome Dr. Cornelia Flora. Welcome.
Yes. And Neil is a rural sociologist. So she has been looking at these issues for a long, 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 long time, and we're still trying to figure it all out. But we're going to talk about some very wonky concepts like structural income inequality, food import dependency. And we're going to start off with the idea that it's from a book that Neil's going to tell us about. But basically, I want you guys to all know that the individual responsibility discourse is elitist, which means, basically, that even though we think we have a lot of choice in what we eat and it's up to us to, you know, change the food system through consumer demand, only if you're in the top of the income pile can you do that. So, Neil, tell us about this book and all of this stuff and what's a person to do?
Well, this book is by actually a very good friend of mine, Gerardo Otero. He is a person of Mexican birth who teaches in Canada. And I actually.
So he knows a lot about NAFTA,
A lot about NAFTA. Mm-hmm. He and I started working together on NAFTA, just simply its impact on sugar production, mm-hmm. possibly 20 years ago, just sort of about the time NAFTA was coming forward. So this is something he has really tried to look at, and his concern is, how is this being structured? What does it mean for farmers, farm workers, and mostly, and also for sort of ordinary people in all these countries? And what he found through an incredible research.
It's like
agenda,
a labyrinth of research in this.
He has found that some of the things that we've already noticed. Americans have stopped getting taller. We're simply getting fatter. Among OECD, which means the countries, developed countries, we are the country with the lowest food prices and the most expensive medical system. We are also the country with the highest increase or decrease in our life expectancy, which is hugely diet-related, according to researchers. So something is going on that is not good for us, and it becomes very easy if we just say, oh, people make such bad choices.
Yeah,
it's all about bad choices.
Cut out those donuts and Doritos, and everything will be fine.
And what he argues, and what is interesting, this came up when we were working in northeast Iowa on local food systems, is how do we make the healthy choice the easy choice? And that talks about food accessibility. That is to say, it's not only that it's in the grocery store, but you can afford to buy it.
Right. Well, broccoli is way more expensive than Cheetos. We got a problem.
And we do. And we have done everything possible to make what my mother used to call empty calories, which are basically carbohydrates.
They're still empty. Your mother was right.
As cheap as possible. So I can go into a 7-Eleven and for a couple of bucks get 2,000 or 3,000 calories.
And it does fill your tummy up.
And if you're a mother of four children and a single mother, filling up is going to be your first goal. Even if you know that it would be better if they were filling up on apples, oranges, and carrots, the Doritos do it better. And if you
and besides, children love Doritos, and they don't like carrots mostly.
Well, children, it turns out, love what they've been fed.
What they know.
What
right?
they know. And, in fact, interesting enough, there's interesting research that's been done on women of different ethnic groups who are in the United States short-term, say, for graduate study, and they make very sure that while they're pregnant, they eat their traditional diet so that their children are getting that when they are the fetus is developing.
So, I don't know if this is true, but I often had the theory that, you know, the flavors of the mother's diet go into the breast milk.
Oh, absolutely.
And then that's where children learn to like spicy food and this and that. And
that, and this is also one of the things that we already know, that so your tastes are not when we generalize children, just as when we generalize people, we're making some really serious errors of which children where and what are their parents' options, because parents have a lot to do with this, but parents often don't have the choices that upper middle class white Americans have.
The parents are part of the culture at large.
Well, and they're part of the economy at large. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Gerardo is talking about is that we have made the easy choice the unhealthy choice. We have huge structures in place to keep producing more and more and more corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton.
And that leads to that Wonder Bread.
And so we have diets that are heavily subsidized. We have farmers who, simply because it makes economic sense,
and barely at and that,
barely
right?
at that, have structured themselves into something like, I can't use my combine for anything else. I can't use my tractor for anything else. All I can grow, I had a grower.
Is what the government is subsidizing,
subsidizing
me to grow, right?
But also, and all that's all I have the equipment to grow.
And the only market, you know, where are you going to sell that rye flour and that those oats? We've only got co-ops for corn and soybeans around here.
So we have the structures in place to, frankly, ensure that Americans are fat and unhealthy.
And this is called the free market, right? Where the farmers don't really have a choice. The consumers don't really have a choice.
And this stems from the term that is used in the title of
the book.
Dr. Otero. It's called the neoliberal diet, healthy profits, unhealthy people. And the term neoliberalism is one that is kind of hard to understand. Because
we're thinking liberal.
We're thinking liberal. We're thinking, oh, those are the people who really want to feed hungry babies and who want to make sure that everybody has access. Well, no. Neoliberal stems basically from 1776 with Adam Smith publishing The Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith...
It's like our grandfather economist.
Yes. Saw the world made up of individuals who made decisions based on their own self-interest, and therefore a free market without regulation, enhancing trade, would allow equals to negotiate prices.
Equals. There you go.
And
equals.
And the notion was you have free flow, you have total information about what you're buying, and therefore, each individual will make a rational decision. What he didn't consider was, from the very beginning, how unequal the market already was.
Right. During his lifetime, we were in the midst of heavy colonialism, which changed the globe completely to what we have today.
But the rules that he came up with were beloved, particularly of the Chicago boys economics.
The merchant class.
Which is, one, no regulation. Mm-hmm. No regulation. No barriers to trade.
Free, right?
And so it's interesting when we look at our current regime in this country, we certainly are having no regulations, and that means not just regulation on food, but no regulation on protecting the environment, no regulation protecting workers, no regulation protecting water. But we haven't quite given in to total free trade because we want to force people to buy what we produce.
Well, and we also are subsidizing heavily. The government is heavily subsidizing certain aspects of industry.
Yes.
And now, when they pay a good subsidy for broccoli, we might be on the right track.
We could be. But we also need to have workers, particularly those that do the 4D jobs.
Oh, yeah, the pickers.
Which are dangerous, dirty, devalued.
Dangerous, dirty, and devalued.
And yeah. That they can earn a decent living so they can also even afford to buy the vegetables they pick. Or that the people who work the kind of jobs that keep us going, such as trash collectors.
These days, even teachers.
Teachers.
Nurses.
That they can afford to buy what they know they should eat. So part of the neoliberal approach to all of this, and it's called financialization. Financialization means we judge everything based on how much profit it generates. We don't judge it by how is that profit distributed, and we don't judge it on anything else. Therefore, our Supreme Court has reified this or made it real by saying the highest and best goal of a corporation is profits for shareholders. So when we gave a big tax break to business, which
recently again.
And we saw executive salaries increase heavily. We saw a few mergers and acquisitions, but mostly what we saw was the use of all this extra cash for stock buybacks.
It didn't trickle down, Neil.
No.
What happened?
It meant that those – and the stock buybacks, what does that mean? It means that the corporation buys its stock from the investors and keeps it for itself and therefore distributes the profits to the
– To fewer people,
to
basically.
Fewer people.
Yeah.
And particularly those on the board of directors, those who are in corporate
officers. The people that already have a lot.
Yes. So this whole notion of free trade and somehow it will make everything better. If we just gave corporations more money, they'd be more responsible. They have absolutely no motivation to be responsible other than their own consciousnesses. And we have what are called activist investors who work very, very hard to buy activist investors. They're saying, we think your stockholders should get even bigger dividends. So don't pay workers more. Don't follow any of these safety regulations. Just give us more.
So more.
That's what an activist investor is. Aren't there also people out there that says, no, you should buy free trade coffee? And their voice must not be as loud as the other folks, though.
Well, we talk about two kinds of power in our society. We talk about people power and money power. And unfortunately, particularly since, again, some more Supreme Court decisions, money power carries the day. So that if you...
Is that because corporations are people?
Corporations are people and money equals speech.
Mm-hmm.
So however much you spend and wherever you get that, you don't even have to necessarily reveal who is paying you to
lobby
for deregulating everything. This is sort of the structural problem that will require local organization, but is confronted against the money power versus the people power. And unlike Vance and other authors who believe it's all just a matter of poor people making bad decisions, Dr. Otero is arguing no. This, and he finds it from a lot of other studies as well, it is because that this is the only thing available to them at a price they can afford.
Yeah, there's been a term that is, the past couple of years, we heard about the term food desert, which is really, truly,
And we have some in Iowa, hard to imagine, right?
A lack of a place for people to buy food of almost any kind, except maybe some, like you mentioned, a convenience store kind of food. And whole communities of people, we don't do so well on that kind of food, no?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the, maybe 60 or 70 years ago, rural people were actually healthier than urban people. They had gardens. There was a notion of
plenty of physical exercise, yeah. Better air.
That has now shifted.
Oh.
And now life expectancy is much better if you, frankly, live in a suburb than either the inner city or rural areas.
Right, and you go to the gym and you eat. You go to the juice bar and you shop at Whole Foods.
Again, the thing is, isn't this wonderful? These people are making healthy choices. They must be well-educated, and generally they are. But it's not the education that allows them to eat healthy foods. It is the fact they have the money to do it. And I think this is our concern, because if we think of society as not just a collection of random individuals. And what is so interesting is we have both Marxist theories of capitalism and the neoliberal explanation of the world is that these are just all individuals making individual choices and so workers are like potatoes in the sack. You need to move wherever you can get a job. And so you have no connection with place or other people. So by losing connection to place, because you cannot afford to stay in a place very long, mm-hmm. you then lose your ability to find others who think similar to you. You don't have the ability to, say, join a community garden where you can raise some of your own food. This breaking up, this low length of residency, which is increasing because
people...
break
social structure.
You break down social structure.
And family structure.
So this is... So, and for traditional societies, and I work a lot in a number of traditional societies, the families are what make people survive and be healthy. And in Andean cultures, we have rituals of respect. And those rituals of respect... are for people and place. And those are terribly important because they unite people around. The food system is a piece of it, but it's just a piece of it. But so many of the groups with which I work, including the Hopi and in the highlands of Peru and Ecuador, are reclaiming their traditional diets. And it's very exciting. And I've been doing more work in Africa now, and you still see this same notion of what did we eat? And one of the things that is happening is that as what was called the enclosure movement in England was, we'll take away common land.
Loss
of the commons.
Which is what we're now calling privatization.
And that is supposed to mean... So if you privatize land, and this we saw this on reservations, and interesting enough, the Hopi's land was so desolate they were able to resist privatization.
No one wanted it.
Except the Hopis. And they would argue we can't privatize this land because rainfall and hydrology is so variable that it wouldn't be fair if we can't rotate where we grow crops. And of course, as we're knowing, rotating where you grow crops is very good
soil
for
fertility.
Even desert soil. Mm-hmm. So we've seen this greater and greater enclosure. For example, I have friends from Appalachia where we have done quite a bit of research, and they are noticing there's more and more land that is now being fenced. When people first move, they move from the borderlands in England to Appalachia, and they were able to survive. They had land, they had a cow, they had a pig, they had chickens, they had a garden. And so when coal mining came in, the workers could be organized and resist because they could support themselves.
They could feed themselves when
they went on strike. Well, that quickly was remedied by making sure nobody had any access to land. And we're seeing that now even more, that somehow this land is privatized. We're not sure who owns it, but there's sure lots of no trespassing signs. So a whole lot of food that people who've lived in a place a while, including in Appalachia, eat, are gathered foods. Not just roots and berries, but leaves and all sorts of things, and, of course, hunting. But once that, and it's very interesting, we have lots of regulations for the poor and none for the rich. But as soon as you start saying, well, you can't hunt on this land, but we have game preserves for the wealthy who will just mount the heads on their wall.
Yeah, and what happens, like around here, we have too many rabbits and too many deer. How silly. They're both delicious to eat.
We're talking about the use of land and the commons and how we feed ourselves. And let's make that a little fairer. You are listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are here at the kitchen table talking about food inequity. There's people that we don't all get to eat off the top of the pile, I guess. No, we don't. We're talking with Dr. Cornelia Flora about a book called The Neoliberal Diet. And it's an exploration of why, well, not just why we make the food choices we do, but why we have to make the food choices
we do. Yes, and why obesity is a problem, and not just among poor people. All of us have these issues.
Well, one of the interesting things at the World Food Prize this year, and I think this is very important, for the almost the first time, there was a time, actually, when two presidents, Ghana and Brazil, got the World Food Prize because they worked for equity in food distribution. Interestingly enough, one was overthrown.
Explain what that is.
Food equity. They made sure that poor people in their country had access to food. And this was huge. And so they promoted all sorts of ways of both local food growing, access to land, access to the variety of foods that were in traditional diets.
Okay, so Iowa
but
farmers.
But they're both.
Go ahead.
One was, they were both overthrown, and one is now in prison. So that.
There you go. The moral of the story is for those do-gooders, right. Hmm. Well, I think a common problem, you hear lots of Iowa farmers very proudly and claim that, of course, we have to grow all this food because we need enough food to feed the world. We're feeding the world in Iowa. Okay. What's going on here, Neil?
Well, this is a wonderful, wonderful thing to feel that those hungry children in Africa or Guatemala,
right, we're trying
or
to do the
inner
right
city
thing here.
Will have enough to eat. The problem, of course, is that what we're growing are things people really don't eat very much. That corn, that is a new world crop. It was something that was from mid-America south to practically to Patagonia, this was an indigenous corn with all sorts of different varieties that were made, which were localized. They were domesticated, and people kept varieties of them because there was an understanding that every variety was good for something. So you needed diversity.
So they weren't just all growing corn for high fructose corn syrup.
No, they were not. And because each one tasted a little different. But the other thing that happened with the corn was when it was prepared, and of course this was women's work, you either soaked it in lye or ashes, which is a good source of lye, or as with the Hopi, you stirred the ashes into the batter.
What's that called? Nixtamalization?
Nixtamalization, yes. And but the Spanish who came and thought, gee, this is a great crop, we can feed our poor people, failed to talk with the women, of course. So they took back to Europe corn. So
one step we left out. The nixtamalization actually transforms the corn and releases more amino acids, so it becomes a much more bioavailable. So you're right. Getting better nutrition from the corn.
Exactly. So that in the olden days, and still this is true in the Hopi, you can go for days just eating pihi bread, which is basically made of
corn.
Or
tortillas or masa. The same thing. Yeah.
But you can only do that if this nixtamalization has occurred. But we took to Africa, we took corn, and we have mealy meal, so you can fill up, but you're not getting those nutrients the corn has in it. So if we can do an analysis of corn, saying there are lots of nutrients here, but if we don't release the nutrients, the bioavailability,
we can't digest that.
Yeah. So it just this is becomes a real problem.
So this contributes to obesity, right?
It contributes to obesity, and it contributes to shorter life because of lack of the proper nutrients. And therefore, we come up with these wonderful inventions, like we're going to make golden rice.
Oh.
we'll put in various vitamins that are missing. Well, when I first started working in the Philippines, I'm very old, by the way.
That and wise.
when we worked there and we'd go to villages, you would eat a whole lot of gathered leaves, which would be weeds, but they tasted great and could supplement and were served with rice. Then we had miracle variety rice and Green Revolution rice. And what the Green Revolution did, which seems sensible at the time if we thought the only problem with people is they don't get enough calories.
Right, quantity.
We made input responsive varieties of both animals.
Input responsive means
it really likes a lot of water. Yeah. It takes a lot of external nutrients. And you grow it all together, so therefore you need more herbicides and more pesticides because a bunch of the same thing together is inviting pests. So if you were eating rice are around, so suddenly all those weeds that grew around the rice paddies are gone because
herbicides.
So those nutrients had to be, we tried to put it in the rice. And then, because again, they didn't talk to the women, they put it in the wrong kind of rice. Instead of putting it in japonica rice, they put it in indica rice. One is the short grain, one is the long grain. And it shattered terribly. And if you're a person in India or...
Shattering means it falls off the stalk before you can harvest it or during harvest.
But that's part of it. But the other part is that when you're pounding it to take the
The
hull's off. It just shatters the whole thing. So it was totally geared for industrial societies. And this is true, by the way. There's some really wonderful indigenous rice varieties in Africa that, again, would be grown in the same manner. So we sort of set up a system where we are feeding the world through calories. But of course, the corn we grow is not really terribly edible, but animals apparently will eat it if that's
right.
all they're given.
It's for animal food and ethanol.
And that one of the problems with it, or again, one of the resistance, I see this as resistance to it. Again, this is doing work in Oaxaca, Mexico, and we stayed with some
political resistance.
No, not political resistance.
Social,
economic, food resistance.
So resisting larger corporations.
Right.
Yeah,
okay. Resisting the diet, but it's not even seen as that. It's sort of saying we retain who we are by our food.
Right.
So in the milpa, where the men grow the corn for the market, you're growing Green Revolution varieties. By the house in the garden, the women maintain their diverse varieties of corn. So when you eat tortillas in those households, they're just incredibly good and very healthy because you're still doing it the old way. So this resistance to neoliberal diet is coming basically from women who would never say, I'm resisting the neoliberal diet. They would simply say, I am feeding my family what we have always eaten, prepared the way we've always prepared it, and this is who we are. And if your food as identity is your bag of Cheetos versus that handcrafted tortilla.
And we can do this in our own culture, too. I have often explained this by saying for years, because I'm very old, too, that I try to only eat what my grandmother, not what she ate always, but what she could have eaten, which means I don't really drink a lot of soda. It didn't exist when my grandmother was around. By going to the things that we know that work well, we can all do this. We don't have to live in some foreign country. We all have family traditions.
But the other thing that is interesting, I'm working with a very interesting international development group in something called sustainable intensification. Now,
sustainable intensification,
which means you're serving the soil, you're serving the environment. Mostly important, you're serving the people where they are with what they do. And so the projects I visited in Senegal and Burkina Faso, first of all, you have to understand what people are currently doing. And people are very smart. These farmers, although they once were herders, and again, the enclosure of land means they're having to settle out, but they keep animals. So you've got your crops and your animals, and the crops and animals work together. But we want to make it easier for the animals. So some working with local blacksmiths to make, so you, instead of plowing the land, you just dig a furrow. This is sort of how a lot of people are planting now. You just make a little slash in the land, insert a seed, cover it up, and you can do this.
Kind of no-till kind of thing.
Kind of no-till, yeah, because
yeah.
you don't want to release, I mean, you want to keep nutrients in the soil.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this works really well, but it's working with a local blacksmith. It's not saying, okay, North American company.
Yeah, John Deere's going to make a plow for all of us.
And then, but these are pulled by animals. Women use donkeys and men use cows. So we're working for, instead of the traditional harnesses, we're working on more animal-friendly harnesses. But the other thing is these are dual-purpose crops, which means the nutrients are in, particularly zinc, but other nutrients are in the grains, which people eat, and in the stover, or the stalks, which animals eat. Now, it used to be just sort of threw the stover on the ground and then the nutrients would evaporate off. But again, our local blacksmiths are developing cutters, and a lot of schools are having the students, it's not called teaching, it's called doing, chopping the stalks.
So are they making silage then,
And they
basically?
Make silage, and they put it in some sort of plastic or other container. And then when it's time to sow the grains, which happens to be the hungry season. This is when you sort of run out of food, and it's before the rains. You're not sure when the rains are going to come. Animals, of course, are in their weakest condition. But if you can feed them this silage, you can before they plow, they can be strengthened. So this makes sense. And the other thing is, in these fields, in both Burkina Faso and in these arid areas, there are bushes with incredible fertility in their leaves, and trees the same way. Well, if you had big tractors, you'd tear those all out. But with a donkey or a cow, they can go around them and keep the innate fertility but been increasing it as well. The other sort of really interesting piece is for some, we're working with three systems that were peanuts and...
These are the three indigenous crops?
Well, they're crops that are, and somehow I have millet. Sorry,
millet.
Millet. Dual-purpose millet, which
right.
I have learned to love in Africa. It makes wonderful soups. Mm-hmm. It does all sorts of really delicious things you can do with millet. And peanuts, which are a good nitrogen-fixing legume. Mm-hmm. But they added another legume, which is prevalent in other parts of Africa, which are cowpeas. And people... would tell us, they told us this in Burkina Faso, I really like planting the cowpeas because you're intercropping, you're keeping rotations going. But we're never hungry anymore because we can really easily cook these in the field.
Uh-huh.
So that you can harvest some of them and then you can cook them. And these are, legumes are much healthier than the grains alone, but the grains are now more healthy for humans.
Yeah, and we have
well.
To remember the peanuts are actually a legume. They are not. They are not a nut.
They are a legume. Yes,
right.
And often women make homemade peanut butter that they sell on the market. So these are really interesting sort of miniature income generation projects.
And in the meantime, they are feeding themselves without being beholden to large multinational. Agribusiness.
Home processing.
What right. Good. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about this show at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. So, who are we going to get our food from? And just the act of buying food, that's an agricultural act. We are supporting things that we want to support. Do we want to support the big agribusinesses and the food that makes somebody a lot of money? Or there are alternatives, and we didn't even know about them. We are talking about the neoliberal diet. Give us the name of that book again, Neil.
Okay, it's called The Neoliberal Diet, Healthy Profits, Unhealthy People. And one of the things, of course, the neoliberal model, the neoliberal assumptions, are that, well, everybody will just act in their own self-interest and it will be fine. But the problem is not everybody can act in their own self-interest. So part of the solutions, and I'm talking about some of them I've seen in countries that are still retain a sense of community, a sense of place, a sense of respect for each other, are how can we begin working together to make food that is healthy, affordable, and available to all.
And delicious.
And really enjoy eating it. And we know that food is a great way of getting together with people. And offering food and sharing food. I mean, some people say, well, you know, if you have an event and have food, people will come. And my view is if you have an event and ask people to bring food, they'll come. Because everybody wants to contribute,
and every family wants to feed their children well. So, and that's not always an option. First of all, they don't have the information, they don't have the available products. It's complicated. Who wants to raise a fat child? No one.
Well, on the other hand, I have been in communities where fat babies were greatly admired.
Oh, right, because then at least they're not starving, right?
Right. Yeah. But I think we can do this. I mean, we have to start somewhere, and I think this is where starting locally makes sense. Now, part of this means that those people who can afford it have got to start recognizing you're not going to just always get cheap food. But we also have to think of things like at our CSAs, our farmers markets. What are ways we can make sure that people without two middle-class incomes can eat with dignity? And so I think some of these that we have SNAP benefits available in farmers markets, but not make it a big deal. Part of it is that we don't humiliate people who are using what is rightfully theirs to get a healthy diet.
That seems some of the stigma against even the term organic. People in the back of their minds, I know, still have, oh, organic, that must be like rich folks' food. I don't need any of that. No, I'm just down here. We're just kind of common folk. We don't need that. The discussion about food is changing. I mean, you go places, we're at farmers markets too. Where did this come from? How is this grown? Which one tastes best? And it's good to keep talking about food.
Yeah, it's a big, complicated system, and it still comes down to, you know, individual choice. Hello, it's we've kind of been put in a position to think that that's our only option. But now we know don't have that much choice,
so
do we?
To share the stuff that's happening around the world in different. Are you still in touch with all of these communities that you're visiting and plan or have visited in the past?
I'm in touch with a lot of them.
Good.
And they're running up against some very interesting challenges. Part of this is the financialization. For example, a community we worked a long time in is Cotacachi in Ecuador. And that has turned out to be a great retirement community for North Americans. And they're on communal land. And if you're on communal land, you have an obligation of community service. They call them mingas. And you go out and you help fix a road. You help fix a seque, the irrigation ditches.
The people that retired there do this.
Should have, but they don't.
Oh,
they don't.
Really?
No one tells them about it. They don't bother to speak Spanish, much less Quechua. So you've got this problem of these people coming in, taking land, not understanding they're part of a community.
There's no – the responsibility of being in the community is not enforced or taught.
Or not taught to them. I mean, this is part of the neoliberal model is the people who have usurped the communal land.
The rich people can pay for it.
The rich people can pay for it. And so the person who did that is making a lot of money. But it weakens the community. So to see them working to resist – trying to say, okay, how do we educate people about what it means to live here? It's not just because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Here's that the reason people have lived here and survived here for so long is because we help each other out. So that sense of mutual obligation, the sense of protecting the place and the people in it is really, really important. So,
and we want to do that here in Ames also.
That's a really interesting model. Expect a lot of help from each other. That's what you can do.
Yes,
this.
And give back to your community wherever your community is.
And I think we work on that a lot. And I think there are ways we can do it. And I'm proud of all the volunteer opportunities in Ames, but I think we could do even more around food. We have a lot of what I view as food with dignity. Things like Food at First and the food pantries that we do not do means tests for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. For example, we take meals to the emergency residence shelter. But our view, this is not charity. This is fellowship. So we go, we sort of finish our prep there. We sit down and we eat and we talk to people. And frankly, we learn so much from these.
You know, it's nice living in a small town the size of Ames because we have the opportunity to know each other more completely.
But we, even in Ames, we're a fairly segregated community.
Yes, absolutely.
I think a lot of talking can be done around those of us that can afford because we are – the economics of food is a really – this we live in a capitalistic system here. So that's how things work. And like you said, that's what the price that goes to the shareholders is our holy grail. And that – at least we have to be aware of that. And then we can start working – on a new model, perhaps.
And I think part of it is get us used to paying more for food.
Yeah.
Those of us that can afford it, and then figuring out ways that by paying more for food, we can perhaps give the people who work producing it more income.
Right. Paying more to the farmers is a very good idea.
And keeping things local. Save a little gasoline. We don't ship everything from California. No, we don't.
Boy, it's hard to know where to make choices in this system. I guess the first thing is all of us personally set our intentions. And this is not a new idea. There's a biblical thing. It's called the golden rule. Do unto others. This is based on caring and ethics and appreciation for what we have.
Because we all live on the earth together and we're all others. We're all in this together. Yes, we are. Thanks for joining us today, Neil.
Cornelia Flora.
Very good. And we talked about the neoliberal diet. I learned a lot about how we think about food. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So here on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we talk about food. And yes, we talked about food today, too.
Forgot to mention, Cornelia is also the president of the board of the radio station.
See?
And at our community radio station, we try to give back to the community entertainment, information, encouragement. That's KHOY.
You betcha. Good. I'm KHOY here. We have some upcoming things happening here.
Oh, yes. Another big weekend coming up.
Yes. With this evening, this is a food-related thing, and I'll just make this quick. The Master Matrix Community Meeting discussing animal confinement regulations here.
This is in Nevada.
Tuesday, January 22nd, 7 p.m. tonight in Nevada. People are interested in this, and I'm sure people will talk about that.
It's about planning major considerations for land use and air and water qualities
right
in our neighborhood.
This Saturday, there's a meeting in the Iowa Prairie Network, Winter Seminar at the Ames High School. That's Saturday afternoon. Yes.
There's, of course, the Robert Burns Dinner at Ryman Gardens on Friday.
We will have a haggis report next week.
Men in kilts. Oh, lots and lots of fun.
Right.
That's Friday. And then Saturday
evening, there is
our very own Lana Noctical will be calling
a
dance.
Dance coming up. Dance to the music of the Boonie Tunes. Alice McGarry, Nate Kepperman from Boone, Iowa, and Amber Gaddy and David Calvin from Boone County, Missouri. So four musicians, the Boonie Tunes. And we'll be calling Contras and Square Saturday, January 26th. Find us on Facebook, Central Iowa Barn Dance Association. That'll be fun. That's a food-related thing. It's a community-related thing. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We gather here every Tuesday at noon or 7 p.m. anytime. You can go to khoyfm.org, stream, download, or go to the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage and find archives, recipes, stuff that more things that you ever wanted to know about the Donna Lana Kitchen. And there's lots of other fine programming on this station, too. We had music today by Reginald R. Robinson from his ragtime collection called Man Out of Time. Support this community radio station. If we are in your ears, put us in your heart. support us.
And your pocketbook.
This is a good opportunity to build community. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.